Welcome, podcast listening trainees, to the Three Men and a Retrospective's look at the entire Mission Impossible film franchise. Join IMF agents Garrett, Matt, and Adam as they review each film in the Tom Cruise starring saga about Daredevil agent Ethan Hunt and his team of world-saving emissaries. Pay attention, trainees, as knowledge of all that is discussed will determine whether you are worthy of joining the Impossible Mission Force. So strap yourselves in, IMF trainees. The Percolated Media Mission Impossible Retrospective begins now.
Mission Impossible 2, released May 24th, 2000. Budget was $125 million. Box office, $546.4 million. And this was directed by the Woo himself, Mr. John Woo. Alright, well, while last week's movie was kind of problematic, it still made a shit ton of money. And it didn't take long for Cruise and his producing partner, Paula Wagner, to decide, you know what, we got to make another one. Now, that's kind of surprising, given that Cruise has never been a sequel guy.
Up to that point, no. I mean, look, we wouldn't get Top Gun for almost 40 years after that came out. And Mission Impossible notwithstanding, I don't think he's done any sequels. Not that The Mummy was going to spawn a franchise. Oh, wait, he did the second Jack Reacher movie. It's more of a recency thing.
Oh, Jack Reacher. Series I've never seen, actually. Never seen either of those.
Neither have I.
All right, Adam, 2000, you and I, we were going through one of our let's not talk to each other stages. And so around this time, were you looking forward to another Mission Impossible? You were a pretty big fan of last week's film. How excited were you for Mission Impossible 2?
I was happy that they were coming back. I was ready for another one. It was a new millennium, literally. I was happy to see that they were bringing it back. It took longer than I would have thought, but I was excited. I thought the trailers were very post-Matrix, I guess you could say, in its marketing. But I was excited. I was ready to get Ethan and IMF team so that it was back together. So this was a theater watch. Couldn't have been more excited.
Guess what? This was also a theater watch for me. I went opening weekend, May 24, 2000, and I was stoked. I was so stoked, guess what? I was also toked. I was pretty high when I saw this for the very first time, and I came out of there really loving this film to the point where I would defend it to anybody who would put it down, and I was like, that Tom Cruise? You know what? That guy knows how to entertain. And then, well, anyone who has listened to me and Matt's previous review of this knows how that's gone. But you know what? I came into this viewing with a very open mind. Matt, sir, what about you? Were you going into this with an open mind?
I almost had no choice because it's been 7 years since I rewatched this. So my taste might have changed. And I have certainly, I don't want to say come around on the first one. My thoughts are basically identical to what they were, but that didn't mean the opportunity would not present itself with this one.
All right. 4 years. That's quite a long time to come up with a sequel, but they got things going pretty quickly. When the first Mission Impossible was released, like I said, Cruise and Wagner were like, let's make another one. So they hired William Goldman to come in and write a script, and he was jettisoned pretty quick. Paul Wagner says it was because he had a back issue. He was kind of in some pain when he was writing it, so he kind of backed out of this. Goldman himself says that the only thing that's really still in the film is a part of the climax, but he was gone. And then we got Matt, you know these guys pretty well, Ronald Moore and Brandon Braga. They came in. They worked with Cruise a lot on this. It was a series of months that they worked on this, and they tried hashing out a script. Now, Matt, as a Star Trek fan, you're aware of these guys, right? How do you think this would have gone?
Well, not especially promising as far as their movies. Television, they wrote a lot of TNG. I think they wrote like 20-something episodes. So I know of their work, but Star Trek on film is in a lot of ways very different than Star Trek on television. Although the pendulum has swung the other way with what's happened to Star Trek in the last decade or so. So that kind of puts blinders on me when I assess this movie, because I think a lot of their tendencies are here. And it's just ironic that this is not the only Star Trek connection we're going to have in this retrospective.
Cruise then called an old friend of his, somebody who I think would have been interesting if he would have tackled this, guy by the name of Oliver Stone. He was called because Cruise had a pleasant experience with him doing Born on the 4th of July, and Cruise got an Oscar nomination because of it. And again, he took a while to hash out a script with none other than Christopher McQuarrie. He was brought on to kind of pitch his idea, and his idea was to kind of do, as Adam had mentioned, this was the millennium, so he was going to do Y2K bug kind of thing with this series. And according to McQuarrie, Stone looked at him and was like, yeah, that's not believable, dude. So at that point, McQuarrie kind of threw up his hands. He was like, okay, well, I'm low on the totem pole, so you guys do what you do. Matt, Oliver Stone, how's that idea?
In 2000, not as good as it would have been in 1988. I think the real turning point in his career was Natural Born Killers, because after that movie, he basically lost his mind. I like Nixon for what it is, although it's not for historical authenticity, because it's about as fictitious as Mission Impossible 2 in a lot of ways. But I don't know how he would have handled this type of movie, because he could do action, certainly, because Platoon has some pretty authentic war sequences, as does Born on the 4th of July when they actually do the intercutting. But I don't know how this would have turned out, because Oliver Stone, this movie is not subtle as it is. We'll talk about someone's ego as we get into the movie. I wonder if this would have turned into a massive behind-the-scenes scuffle. And honestly, Tom Cruise would have won out over Oliver Stone, if you ask me. Certainly, if I'm looking at the position of Paramount, which horse am I going to back? I'm probably going to go with one of the biggest movie stars in the world over a director who his best days were behind him.
Yeah, Cruise, this was the peak of his powers at this point. He really was pretty much running Paramount with Sherry Lansing around this time. Adam, Oliver Stone, how do you think that would have gone?
I do think that he would have taken this franchise back and to the left.
Jesus Christ.
I'm almost embarrassed.
You're going to hell for that one.
I agree with Matt. I think 88 as opposed to 2000, you get different filmmakers. I do think he would have been brought in to be a shooter for whatever Tom would have wanted. That might have been good for Stone career-wise. Not that he's ever hurting, but come on, a film by Oliver Stone doesn't get butts in seats anymore. But it would have been okay. I just think none of that stoneness would have been in this film. It would have been kind of what it is, cruise control.
It sure is.
I should also mention that if Oliver Stone directed this movie, it would have been much more of the government manufactured the virus. Mm-hmm.
And oh, God,
this would have been a massive takedown of the American political system. That's not what we needed at this time for a summer action movie.
So you're saying what we needed was this?
Well, sometimes it's be careful what you wish for, but also Adam mentioned something correctly. I know it happens. This is a post-Matrix movie, and somebody clearly loved The Matrix, because it's right down to the goddamn movie poster with that leather jacket he's wearing.
And according to De Palma, even though Cruise and him had some battles on the set of the first Mission Impossible, Cruise did call him and ask him to return, but De Palma was like, fuck no, I got this other movie I'm doing called Mission to Mars. Why he wanted to make that, I don't know. Oh, what a terrible movie that is.
He accepted that mission.
Yeah, exactly. What is wrong with that guy? But no, he didn't want to return, so Cruise, for some reason, had been watching some Hong Kong movies around this time, and of course, John Woo had Broken Arrow and Hard Target and Face Off, so he called up John Woo. Now, I remember John Woo getting a lot of hype coming in. There were a lot of Asian filmmakers getting some hype. John Woo, out of all of them, was getting the most hype. And I have to say, man, I remember all the hype around this guy. I was working in a video store at this time, and I rented his Asian action films. I rented The Killer. I rented A Better Tomorrow. I did not like either. Face Off made a shit ton of money, but I don't know. Matt, you're the John Woo fan, aren't you?
Yeah, I am so much of a Woo enthusiast, I might as well be dressed like Ric Flair for this podcast. And it's appropriate because his movies are Flair. And you have to remember, a lot of the stuff he did, that whole gun-fu, slow-motion, hyper-stylized Mexican standoffs, in a lot of ways, he was the pioneer for that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at a time where the action stars of Asia were doing a lot more martial art and stunt work, your Jet Lis, your Jackie Chans, etc. He presented something totally different with using firearms to complement martial arts. His movies are ultra stylized. Hard Boiled is a great movie. I think that was the last one he did before he jumped to America. Yeah. But something did kind of get lost in translation for his first couple movies. I will say Face Off, I think, is the perfect marriage in a lot of ways, because it's got all the stuff John Woo, people make fun of him for, but also praise him for. but it also is not too Americanized, because unlike this movie, Face Off is a hard R, almost in a Verhoevian type of way with the violence. I mean, there's no like face melting or anything like that. There's face removals, but that one is very over the top and bombastic. But I think that movie works. I love Face Off. And I think, let's also remember, I wonder if Tom Cruise called John Travolta and said, hey, what do you think of me bringing this guy in?
Two Scientologists. Yep.
And Face Off made a shitload of money.
Like, it did.
And look, that movie was made for $80 million. Nowadays, that would be made for like $200 million. This was made for more than that. I think this was like $125-ish. So he's working with more money. But with the exception of Tom Cruise, not like they had to pay a lot of other actors. They had to pay for John Travolta and Nick Cage, who were two big stars at the time.
Here's the thing. I understand bringing this guy in to give a different flavor. But with how this script turned out, as pretty much a remake of Notorious, and we'll talk about it as we talk about the film, but that's not something you bring John Woo in for, you know?
Nope. But that's not his Hong Kong films. In a certain amount of way, they're action films, but they're also relatively complex stories. Although the killer's pretty straightforward. But I could see getting him for just a big action movie, but John Woo and Hitchcock aren't two things I associate with each other, which is ironic because if you thought somebody would have remade Hitchcock's Notorious, it would have been De Palma with his first movie.
Adam, were you also on the Woo train? Were you hyped up to see this and see what John Woo could have done with this?
It was, especially because Face Off, I don't know if anybody can consider them a fan of that movie. What you are is you're a devotee or you're not. You have to go full Cage and Travolta just to watch that film. And it's a fin delight. But on top of that, I will defend Broken Arrow till my dying day.
Fuck off. That's another terrible film.
That is enjoyable. I'm not saying it's a good film. I'm saying it's watchable. It's cinema. Fuck you, Scorsese. It's one of those just enjoyable fucking nerd rope kind of films. And every now and then you need that. Hard Target, decent little introduction, but I would say Hard Boiled, better to look at for some of his stuff than The Killer and some other things. I was excited, though. It was a different director. I felt like they were kind of selling John Woo in America, even though he had done some films. This was supposed to be his big, big breakout, kind of like Above the Line with Tom Cruise. And I was excited to see what he would bring. This was a time where we were, remember when we discussed it with, oh, God damn it, Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon.
It was a big injection of Asian cinema coming to the U.S. And The Matrix is, almost for all intents and purposes, a Hong Kong type of film in the way that it's shot and staged and action scenes. So, yeah, on the surface, more Mission Impossible and the Woo coming in hyped me up.
It's funny you like Broken Arrow because that's the least Woo of his American movies.
It is. It's very tamped down.
Which I could also see that's why they got him, because this thing went through so much production turnaround. And he had issues on Broken Arrow with studio management. Face Off was originally going to be this really futuristic type of movie, and they rewrote it to make something more contemporary. Mm-hmm. So I could see he had experience with the ups and downs of the American system. And
paycheck.
That was the beginning of the end, to be perfectly honest. Although
was his ticket back to Asia. Was that
movie? Yeah. Although he came back with Silent Night, which I really liked, with Joel Kinnaman.
Was his, huh?
Yeah, I liked that one.
Yeah.
Heard that's but, good.
Mm-hmm. That was like 20 years later.
I know.
But yeah, let's also remember this is turn of the millennium. And this was the highest grossing movie of the year.
Crazy.
Yeah.
This made more than Gladiator. This made more than X-Men did. What Lies Beneath made a lot of money. Perfect Storm made a lot of money. These were all movies that were sold on their actors, which this kind of is too. I mean, Tom Cruise is top billed, and boy, he'll let you know it in this movie.
Oh, he sure will. So they shoot this thing. They go a little over long, much to Doug Ray Scott's chagrin. And there is a legend out there that I really did some digging into. There's a legend that the first cut that John Woo turned in was 3.5 hours. That has since been debunked by John Woo himself. I was listening to an interview with him, and he said, that is all legend. What it is there were tons of scenes that were over long, and he trimmed it a lot. But as far as what the cut was, it was maybe another 10 minutes, if that.
It always seems to be the time. Mm-hmm. It always seems to be 3.5 hours is always the
you're right.
posted cut.
Well, to be fair, I might have just meant there was a lot more slow motion. It was the same movie.
I'm telling you.
It's got longer.
Yeah, that was my exact retort when I heard that was, Jesus Christ, you just cut out the slow motion. You have an action-packed hour and a half film here. All right. Well, like I said, opening weekend, I was excited. Bought the soundtrack when I came out. I played this fucking Limp Bizkit song so much when it was out. I thought it was badass. And I was really, really into this film. Adam, when you came out of it, we're not going to talk about what we think now, but when you came out of this initially, did you really like this one?
When I came out of it, I got a different experience than what I was expecting. But soundtrack-wise, I was more excited about I Disappear. Mm-hmm. Like, I was still semi-defending Metallica at the time, but you couldn't avoid MTV or VH1 playing that fucking music video, which is what MTV and Viacom had turned into, was music videos that were just five-minute ads for movies at that point.
It was a huge deal because Metallica had never sold a song to a film before.
Nope. They had not commercialized their stuff in that way. Not for a commercial, not for a film, nothing. But coming out of it, I was not filled with a massive regret. But I'll say this. I think this is probably only the third time I've watched this film.
I was about ready to ask you, because Matt and I reviewed it seven some years ago, and the review that is probably lost to the stratosphere. And the two of us, we mentioned last week, we haven't watched this since we did that review. So you haven't watched it too many times either, huh?
No, this is one of the ones where I saw it in theaters. I may have seen it a second time. I don't know. Sometimes you got a girl, you do crazy stuff. God knows you know. Lucky Matt. But I think I've seen it once when I bought it initially, because you're still buying every video release, and I think that's it.
So we start off with the Paramount logo and the opening strings of a Hans Zimmer score as we're hearing about the search of a hero through this guy named Dimitri. We're seeing a drug called Chimera being injected as we cut to kids playing Terminator 2 style. This is fucking melodrama up the ass. I'm telling you, James Cameron can get away with this shit. Fucking John Woo, when we see this doctor walk out of this lab and he's watching these kids saying, "What am I doing to the world?" God damn it, Matt. This is fucking melodramatic.
It is, but that's also very in tune with how Face Off opens. But you're right, this opening also, even though it's the 2000s, a super virus feels very 90s for some reason.
Yeah, because what, we had Outbreak,
because you would like think this before. Oh god, Outbreak, Resident Evil, the video games.
Oh yeah,
in the 90s. Part of the rationale, I think, was if we did AI or technology, we'd be accused of just doing Terminator with Mission Impossible.
Hold that beer.
And it was in this weird influx of movies made between Matrix and 9/11. There was a huge transition period that happened afterwards. But yeah, this opening, it's super over-stylized. I will say, though, I think the cinematography in this movie is... It has a very distinctive look. But this guy also was Tony Scott's DP.
I was going to say, this is Tony Scott's guy here. In fact, I believe the first one was fired and they brought this guy in. So we see a plane fly overhead with who we think is Ethan talking to a Dr. Dimitri, I guess. And
well, the doctor is Nikorovich. Dimitri is Ethan.
Yeah, so yeah, the doctor keeps calling him.
Don't skip over that airplane, because the original airplane had better effects than that airplane flying in the sky.
They're telling each other that they're sorry as the doctor, who, by the way, I think we just reviewed this guy a couple years ago in Oppenheimer, didn't we? Same look. He's saying that after you've been infected with Chimera for 20 hours, there's no saving you. The oxygen masks are dropped as the cabin pressure in the plane has gone down, but Ethan gets up from his seat as a pilot collapses and the plane is set to crash. We see people laid out as the pilot leaves. This person who we think is Ethan, he comes back and says that he's not Dimitri as he takes out the doctor and then he takes off his mask, reveal the villain of the story, Sean Ambrose, played by would-be Wolverine himself, Doug Ray Scott.
Well, before you get to that, I think this scene, it's pretty bad misdirection, because it's very clear that Ethan, in quotes, is acting strange. He's smiling way too much. And first of all, I don't trust anybody with that haircut.
Oh, God, his hair in this is insane.
I don't think this is all that surprising. Maybe that's the intent, but as we'll find out in this movie, this does not feel like the Ethan Hunt we saw in the first movie, period.
What I heard is they were going to go with the crew cut from last week. But, of course, John Woo does all these motorcycle scenes and everything, and then he wanted to see that hair fly in the wind. So he thought it would look better if they gave him long hair. And my
God. Yeah, because Nick Cage and John Travolta have gorgeous heads of hair. Both of those guys were losing their hair by the time 97 came around.
This scene, though, you could not do this a year later. This is pretty crazy to see. Mm-hmm. Adam, how are you feeling about this opening scene, sir?
I like anytime Tom Cruise is playing somebody kind of villainous or evil. I think partially because it's so against type. He's almost never the villain. So I like...
yeah,
exactly. Or his ex-wife. Mm-hmm. Or his kids. Or you're a couch. It does. I mean, dude did more damage to couches until J.D. Vance came along. Pretty but nice. I like his... I don't know, when he's just acting against himself. And yeah, I don't think it's supposed to be a secret. I don't think it's done well. So I think it's one of those, it's only going to surprise you if you've never seen a movie before. Blue's Clues would be able to figure this out. But I like that kind of evil smile, the way that he does it. So this beginning is, I don't know what I would have thought of the first time I saw it. I almost wish that I could remember. But I do like that it's a little different. And I like that we're seeing somebody playing Ethan evil. Though Ambrose... Other than having dark hair, I don't see how he is supposed to be Ethan and his double. I know we get masks, but fucking hey, he's no Hunt.
All right, let's talk about this. Let's get this elephant out of the room right away. As people who have listened to our Shining podcast know, I don't have too many good things to say about Stanley Kubrick. I will give him this big compliment, though. He fucking saved the X-Men franchise by having Eyes Wide Shut go way over and John Woo having this go way over, because that's what lost him the Wolverine role. God bless him. He is married to Claire Forlani, who is one of the hottest chicks in history. But fuck, this guy has zero charisma. I don't know how this guy was up for that role. I don't know how he got that role. But given his villain role in this, he is terrible.
There's pieces of plywood that have more personality than this guy does. And part of my problem is also just the first one did a rogue agent. This one's doing the same thing, but it's made worse by trying to make him, and they explain this in the movie, he's posed as Ethan Hunt multiple times. So they're really trying to make him sort of his Blofeld or doppelganger. But not only are they physically not resembled enough outside of the dark hair, they have opposite polarities of charisma. And the funny thing is, I could see a 2000 era Hugh Jackman in this role, but I don't see Dougray Scott in this. I think it's awful. I think some of his line deliveries are really flat. He makes some really bizarre facial acting later on in the movie. It's like he's trying to be Nicolas Cage, but he doesn't know how to do that. It's like someone pretending to be someone else. So if there is some kind of, I don't know, sub theme of identity and like posing as Ethan Hunt or like being syndrome where he's a fanboy, but he just can't pull that off. It's not brought to the forefront. He's an anchor, one of several that weighs the movie down.
He's a distraction when he comes on. An anchor is about the best way to put it. It's like he's trying to out-cruise in a cruise production, and it goes poorly. I don't think I've seen anything that I like him in outside of maybe the Batwoman TV series. He was one of the not horrible things in what turned into be a pretty bad show. I don't know who cast him as Wolverine, but I would really like to see how this dude landed that role. Thank you, John Woo, for screwing up this production schedule so that that could be fixed.
If you remember, he was considered to be Bond before they cast Daniel Craig. And I'm like, I don't understand what these casting agents see in this guy.
Well, he had his moment, much like John Woo, and then he was gone as well. Yeah, Matt, you mentioned that they tell us that Ethan has been impersonated by this guy many times while they've been working together. Here's a big, well, one of my many issues I have with this film. Why not show us? Why not give us an instance of them working together, trusting one another, wearing each other's mask? Why aren't we seeing that?
Because GoldenEye did a better version of this 5 years beforehand with that opening prologue. Well, also, this movie overuses the mask thing. The first one, they incorporate it. This one, it's break in case of emergency because they use it every 20, 25 minutes. Someone rips off a mask.
Yeah.
It gets more and more absurd every time. It's cool to have that as one of your gadgets, but that shouldn't be your only mechanism of espionage. And it makes it even dumber because these guys aren't even the same body type. It took a while for them to figure out how to incorporate the masks without using them as a crutch.
It's one thing to put on a rubber mask, but 6-inch height difference. Anybody's going to notice that one. Right.
We then cut to mountains as we see our boy Tom Cruise hanging from the top of one, yet another one of these stunts that Cruise is going to insist on doing, despite insurance and filmmakers sweating over them and insisting otherwise. I'm going to say right now, I said a few negative things about last week's film, but I thought despite the boyishness that my two colleagues pointed out, I thought Cruise was a pretty good foil for when the action came up. Here, he is 1 year removed from an Oscar nomination for Magnolia. He seems to be here to prove that he is still an action star as well. He's flashing that damn smile so much. I find this character in this movie to be fucking obnoxious. And I have never hated Tom Cruise more than I hate him in this movie.
And those that know me know I'm a Tom Cruise fan. I will defend a lot of his different films and movies, Magnolia being one of them. Another one that I'm going to save for later so that I don't get yelled at by Garrett this early in the podcast.
Don't say Vanilla Sky. Just don't.
Well, we already know he's got a hard-on for Vanilla Sky and Oblivion. I mean, how many more surprises can you throw at us? He's going to be the guy that likes that movie night and day with him and Cameron Diaz.
Oh, we already like
James Mingle, but that movie sucks dick.
Oh, God, I hate Cameron Diaz. But I'm going to say my issue is less with Cruise, but this doesn't feel like the same Ethan. This character feels like a different person than we got in the first film. And I think that's more off-putting than almost anything. He's trying to make this into a James Bond character very much in this film, and it doesn't fucking work. But this opening mountain climbing, I like it. For all of you that are just like, oh, he really did this, bro. There were no fucking... Yes, there were. There was every bit of rope, there was every harness, there was a belay, and they were digitally removed. So shut the fuck up. Yes, he free climbed, but he did it with every piece of safety apparatus involved. But I dig this, and as stupid as this helicopter is flying in and shooting these things, I love these sunglasses.
Oh.
I had a pair of Oakley MP3 sunglasses when I was a cyclist that I would wear. And these are a great design. I'm sorry, these glasses are pretty fucking cool. I wish I could find them today. But as stupid as this beginning is, it's fun. And I think this film could use a more stupid fun as opposed to the self-serious, self-masturbatory fun we're going to find later on.
These sunglasses look tackier than the ones James Marsden wore in the X-Men movies. You touched on one of my problems with this series out of the gate. Ethan Hunt feels like a different character every movie up until a point, and this one is no different. He feels like the idealism is gone, the naivete is gone, which is fine because that shows he's evolved as an agent. But he's descended into just 90s indestructible superhero type of agent, like what Brosnan became as Bond, where the only thing he's missing is a cape. And he doesn't have the excuse that guys like Schwarzenegger have of being built like a brick shit house. And too much of this movie feels like Tom Cruise overcompensating and begging to be portrayed as cool first and foremost. I think his ego was at the heights as big as the mountain, and it's to the detriment of the movie because it doesn't feel authentic. It feels like a ploy. It doesn't feel believable. And like I said, he doesn't even feel like the same character. And quite frankly, I think if I have to watch him smile anymore in this movie, I wanted to knock his teeth out because it's so ridiculous.
God, I agree with that line later on.
Well, he had lines like risky put in here just to call back to his older stuff. You're right. His ego is out of fucking control in this movie.
And also, I hate this trope of people landing helicopters at the top of a cliff and they can't hear them coming.
I fucking hate this too. I had that in my notes.
I bitched about this in Alien vs. Predator, and it's almost as bad here. The only difference is nobody steps out of the helicopter.
Yeah. So speaking of the helicopter, it's being driven by Luther. He drops down to pick Ethan up as the Limp Bizkit theme plays, and Ethan puts on the glasses where Anthony Hopkins is here as Swanbeck, his leader. This was originally going to be Ian McKellen, but another X-Men alum, he had other things going on. Doug Ray Scott saying, hey, man, guess where I am?
Well, he Hopkins only shot for a couple days.
Yeah.
But because this thing went over schedule, you have to wonder if McKellen committed to this, would he have dropped out of Lord of the Rings or X-Men?
That's true. Yeah, he had Lord of the Rings going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Anthony Hopkins is uncredited, which is also weird because he's got real FaceTime. He's not just a voice on the other end, which I do like. I like that the secretary or the person in charge changes with every movie. They're getting respectable names. I mean, this is a pretty big get, but also as soon as I see Anthony Hopkins, I'm thinking, oh, he's going to be the big villain. So I'm surprised the movie doesn't pull that card.
They probably would have if he had more time.
I would have watched the dailies and be like, Doug Ray Scott is not compelling enough, so we got to pull something out of our ass. If anything, his henchman is more convincing.
Oh, God. We'll talk about that relationship. So Swanbeck lays out the new mission for Ethan as he says that his mission is to go after an item known as Chimera. He then says that Ethan can choose any two members, but it is essential that the third team member be Naya Nordoff-Hall, who is a civilian and a highly capable thief. He then says Ethan has 48 hours to recruit Hall and to meet him at Savelle to review the assignment. Swanbeck goes on to tell Ethan to let him know where he's going next time he goes on vacation.
I think he brings a level of seriousness and some authenticity to that role. I kind of dig it. I don't always like what they do. I do have a problem with knowing the secretary is secretary of the CIA and the IMF is a contracted company like fucking Halliburton. So it's always kind of weird and I don't think about it too much or else my head's going to fucking explode much like it does. Well, whoop, shit. Sorry, that's next week. But I like him. Hopkins is just, I don't know. There's something pleasant when he shows up into this franchise. I kind of wish he stuck around.
Yeah, I'm surprised he doesn't show up again, at least once in the next few movies.
Maybe he would have if the third one didn't take as long to get made.
Yeah. So the theme pipes up and Ethan throws his glasses at the camera. My God, the credits are rolling and I've already turned on this movie.
Oh, wow. This is... How do you fuck up an already done score?
And not only that, but is there any of these movies that is as aged as this one is? This is straight out of 2000. Last week's movie, yeah, it had some 90s tropes and things in it, but you could pull that out of any era because of the way De Palma shot it. This one with the flan and with the way the action is in slow-mo and everything else, this is so 90s. So we cut to some dance as we see Ethan lingering Lestat style in the background. And this is when we are introduced to Naya, played by Tandy Newton, who was a friend of Nicole Kidman's. And she recommended her for this role. Capes are flying, and we just see them looking at each other for 5 minutes. We follow Naya up the stairs as the dance number is still going on. She checks her compass and sets up some stuff in a bathtub as Ethan comes in and says, I see you found it. Naya says that she's not just a pretty face, and we get this ridiculous scene in this bathtub. Fuck me, man. This is how these two fall in love? What is going on here?
To me, this is them trying to insert some stuff from a different part of the world, from some of that Hong Kong cinemas that doesn't fit here. This all feels so awkward. These guys have worse chemistry than Chimera and Bellerophon mixed. I mean, this is bad. But I get a laugh because if you notice when they're in the bathtub together, they're the same fucking height. So if you want to have fun, go ahead and look up the height for Miss Tandy Newton. And yeah, she's 5'3".
That's funny.
Part of the problem also, they make him too much like James Bond, where he's now like a womanizer, and they really hype up the globetrotting component. I mean, hell, 5 minutes from now, they steal a scene from GoldenEye part and parcel. So they also have negative chemistry, which doesn't help. But I think Tandy Newton has done the biggest disservice in this entire movie because that is an actress who I love, I think is immensely talented. And she is written to be so much of a intellectually devoid tool after this scene that I thought Frank Miller wrote this movie. Because in this opening, we see she's a dependable thief. She can resist Ethan Hunt's charm and has a brain of her own. And that only lasts for this scene. Because from here on out, she is a plot device that is worked by both Ambrose and Ethan Hunt, becomes the literal MacGuffin of the third act to the point where what she does is nonsensical, if you ask me, and is constantly demeaned. And Anthony Hopkins' character literally says the most misogynistic line I've heard in a movie in a long time. This is—I feel so bad for Tandy Newton, and this character is not written well at all. So the fact that they're trying to remake Notorious makes it even more insulting because that character has so much more dimension and is arguably smarter than Claude Rains, and I think it's Cary Grant, could be mistaken. But I hate everything with this character, and I feel so bad for Tandy Newton. And I know she felt really intimidated on this production.
Yeah,
and
she had some pretty bad things to say about this. Well, not about Tom Cruise.
Just
the way that she was intimidated, and he was so intent on trying to make the best movie that he could, she felt really pressured by this production.
Like, this movie is so sexist, though, even James Bond would go... Ooh, we might want to ease up a bit.
And it's amazing because this one, and really this one, we got a few little lines last week, but I don't know what it is about these writers, but the disrespect to women is so bad. And I will give some major credit coming up because I think the Mission Impossible franchise do women characters better than almost any Bond film. But this film does it worse than any Bond film.
Well, the sole screenplay writer credited is Robert Towne. Matt was praiseworthy of last week, and he does these women complete disservice. I agree with you.
And it's also inexcusable. She's the only principal character in this movie who's a woman. So that's also the issue, is everything is just compounded into this one solo character.
And, you know, I mentioned that I would have liked to have seen Hunt and Ambrose on a job together, kind of like how we saw GoldenEye. We're told that Naya and Ambrose were a couple. What was it that made her fall in love with him? What broke them up? Why is he just so accepting of her after she's let out of jail? There's nothing given in any of these lines other than a bunch of stupid looks at one another that tells me anything about what's going on in this story. And I think a lot of that is the mistranslation of Wu's style. I think Wu just does not work for this movie.
You could also could have done something really cool. Knowing that Ambrose played Hunt for so long, they would have worked together to double each other. He would know her.
Yeah. So Hunt climbs on top of her, and then she climbs on top, and he tells her that she'll never find a valuable necklace that she's looking for. But he points out that it's actually on the far left, and she says it's very disconcerting. No shit. She grabs the necklace and then asks who he is as Naya sets off an alarm. Ethan distracts the people who come in and talks them down as she gives the necklace up. Ethan says that he was trying to see how good she was because he was going to recruit her for a job. He then reveals that he was the one who triggered the alarm as she drives off. Speaking of driving off, Jesus Christ. God. We see Naya driving and fleeing from Ethan, and this had me wishing for the meaningful Fast and Furious chases. Ethan drives next to her and says he needs her help as she says, if you want me, you have to catch me. I hate this, especially the slow motion. This is ridiculous.
This is the scene I was referencing that is lifted from GoldenEye, because remember, after the credits of that movie, it's Bond and Famke Janssen being flirtatious and dueling cars on a street that is not a one-way street. Oh my God, this is... I'm cringing a lot in the first 20 minutes of this movie. And it's compounded by these... Look, I like Wu's use of slow-mo. What I don't like is this fucking relic of the 90s of the orchestral choir bullshit. This was also in Gladiator.
So yeah, he did in Gladiator, too.
It's part of the time. Maybe it's a Hans Zimmer issue, but oh my God. We're 20 minutes in, and I'm already like, oh boy, I'm in trouble.
This is so bad, and compounded by the fact it's a fun scene in GoldenEye, that this is such a poor ripoff of that. It makes it so much worse. You are compounding problems right off the bat, and you're just setting up your film. I enjoy the plane scene, but everything since then, he might as well have fallen off that cliff, because that's how I'm feeling.
Maybe he fell off the cliff and went into a coma, so this whole movie's in his head.
Naya crashes and hangs out her car as the mighty do no wrong, because Ethan reaches to save her, and they stare at each other for another set of seconds as she asks his name.
The problem also is Tom Cruise, and we've mentioned this in Top Gun, and I'm sure we'll talk about this throughout the series, he's never had a lot of sexual chemistry with his leading ladies. And it's a hindrance here.
Big time. This movie depends on it, and it falters. We cut to a bedroom as Ethan wakes up and glances at Naya sleeping next to him. He asks what she has against spies, and we get some meaningless talk between the two. He then once again climbs on top of her and says, "Damn, you're beautiful," as they make out some more. Fucking vomit. We cut to some ceremony taking place in Seville as Ethan makes his way through a crowd. By the way, where is his goddamn team?
Well, the team also is considerably smaller than it was in the last movie, because this is the Tom Cruise solo performance. He told the backup dancers to go home for this movie.
And who's this Aussie who we eventually get? God damn, you can't even bring anybody. This is just, ugh. So Ethan walks in and meets up with the mission commander. As he says how annoying the ceremony was, and they both apologize to each other about the vacation talk from earlier. Hopkins then shows Ethan footage of the doctor saying they have a problem, that they need a villain and a hero, and in doing so, they have created a monster. Hero begs to meet in Atlanta, and he can trust no one but Ethan. Ethan hears that the doctor is dead from the flight that crashed in the Rocky Mountains. That took me by surprise. Like, this thing crashed in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado.
Yeah, and they also don't mention that hundreds of people died on that plane.
Yeah, by the way. Swanbuck then goes over that Ethan was there, except Ambrose was the one who replaced him. Ethan says that they had reservations about one another.
Okay, this is also very bad screenwriting, because the movie does a lot of telling about Ambrose and Nia having a history, them impersonating each other, but they never explain why he went rogue. He just did it because he felt like it, apparently. I mean, look, the explanation in the first movie was bullshit, but at least they gave you an explanation.
At least there was an explanation, exactly. Adam, did you have issues with that?
I got issues with a lot, especially with the way that they do face tracking technology and they're not always wearing a fucking mask. This dude went rogue and they know where he is the whole time because they send Nia there. There's no secrets about where this dude is.
The flight crash was made to look like an accident, and Swanbeck says that his mission was to bring Chimera to him. And Nia is the best way to get Sean to confide in her and for her to report to him. I mean, you're depending on the fact that this chick had a relationship with this guy. And
she's only important because she fucked
him. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was getting at.
I hate when people use the term fridging a woman when the Bechdel test is lauded as super important when people don't know the second half of what that means. However, when you look at scripts like this one, I understand where that shit is valid because of just how insulting this is. And to have the line, to sleep with a man and lie with him. She's got all the practice she needs. I mean, this is post Eyes Wide Shut. Did the divorce proceedings already start? Holy fuck.
Swanbeck does have probably the best line in the movie where he says, this isn't mission difficult, it's mission impossible. I do like that line. I use it in the credits for this show.
That's a great
line. But I thought you don't like being winked at.
I don't, but I like in the context of this particular scene.
I was going to say, that shit makes me laugh in the trailer. The TV spots, something about that line. And maybe it's because Anthony Hopkins is maybe the only person on set having fun.
Yeah.
This shit that he's being given. That, fuck, I could use more of him.
Nia says that she doesn't have a conscience and she's a bloody thief. And by the way, this next line, this is the worst acting I've ever seen Cruise do. He's asking if she'd feel better if he didn't want her to do this. And she responds yes. And he just yells, well, then feel better. Terrible line reading.
There's so much to cut. Like how?
Yeah.
That is left in is almost like somebody in the editing room went, I'm going to show him how bad he is.
This is the performance he was stressed over, was shit like this. He wanted to get this right.
I want that shit on his Oscar reel one day.
Yeah, right.
This whole movie, independent of the action scenes, which are trying to make Tom Cruise look cool, these scenes are here because Tom Cruise wants to prove he's an actor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And does he not know there is such a thing as second take? He worked with Kubrick, for fuck's sake.
And he had an Oscar nomination the year before. He's already proven that.
And an undeserved nomination, by the way, because I don't understand why everyone loves that performance, because it's so clear he is squeezing his dying father's hand reciprocally so he can learn how to fucking cry.
I've never seen it, so I couldn't tell you.
Better in Eyes Wide Shut, and I don't care for that movie, but he's considerably better because that movie is all about sexual repression, and I think that's something he has experience with.
Careful. Nia eventually agrees, and we're getting a look at the plan to have her arrested, and they're counting on Sean monitoring her and getting her out. Boy, this is some plan. We then get this huge...
also makes Ambrose look like a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
He's never suspicious. His henchman is the one who has to call it out.
Yeah, we'll see the gotcha scene later. He does eventually figure it out, but you're right. He should have figured it out right off the bat. Why does this chick want to come to me now?
And then she doesn't. That's the point. They got to have him go to her.
Yeah.
Well, this plot is very much, and this movie is very similar. This is the Too Fast, Too Furious of the Mission Impossible movies, where it's the most dated. It's set in beautiful beachside areas. Duke Scott and Cole Hauser are basically the equivalents on the acting scale. And Eva Mendes is written about as badly and serves the same function as Andy Newton's character.
You know, I have a theory as to why this plot is the way it is here and why we get things repeated to us over and over as the movie goes on. They are overreacting to the complaints made at last week's movie. Adam and I mentioned when that movie was out, and me and him remember this because we got all the magazines, we read all the articles, all the complaints were about how fucking confusing that movie was. This time, this is about as basic a plot as you can get, and if it's not basic enough, we're going to have it repeated over and over and over. Later on, we're going to have Ambrose, he's going to realize that she put it in his right pocket instead of his left pocket. He's going to call that out because we don't want the audience to get lost.
It's funny they do that much handholding, but they also don't explain everything. There are still things that you're like, wait, that why or what does that mean? They don't even fully commit to it.
We then get this huge drawn out scene of Nia getting off a boat as Ethan's team, remember them? They're on the scene. Luther says that this ain't funny. Ving, you've never been more right in your entire career, sir.
I mean, he stepped in shit, which is foretelling. of what he signed on for.
He sure did. We're getting a satellite view. As Luther says, the satellite doesn't work as fast as he does. And then Sean and I, they just stare at each other for a set of minutes as Ethan watches the footage and just starts getting jealous.
Oh, this is Twilight level of just staring so into bad. The abyss.
Yes. Naya tells Sean that she's incredibly grateful, and seeing these gay lovers just kind of glance at each other, at them in disgust.
Oh, these two are fucking, and nobody... It's so blatantly obvious, too.
It's so obvious the way they look at each other. Naya is walking through this amazing house as Luther says that she did it, but Ethan responds with, "We just rolled up a snowball and tossed it into hell." This is what the writer of Chinatown came up with, was shit like this?
All right, but this is another one where they built three or four action pieces and then went, okay, write a script to tie it together. But
The music is turned off as Naya tries putting on a dress, but Sean stops it from happening. And then we're hearing about myths that plagued the ancient world. And Luther says, it's that simple, huh? Again, just calling out the fact of how simple this script is as opposed to last week. And then we cut to Sean's house as Sean tells Hugh that they're halfway there. Hugh asks why Naya's there, and he's the one who's figuring this whole plan out. And then we get this cut to the cigar cutter. I wonder if that's going to come into play later.
There are so many checkoff items in this film.
We're setting all this up as Sean holds Hugh's arm and threatens to cut off his finger, which he does. And then we go to a horse race, again, filmed in slow motion as Sean and Naya, they look on, and Hugh lingers in the background. We have this Wallace character. He shows up to give Naya an earpiece, and she finds Ethan using her binoculars. She says it's just like old times, and she gives her outline to what and who is around Sean's place. And then we cut to John McCoy, played by, and I forgot he was here, Brendan Gleeson, who is Nickervich's boss, cozying up to Ambrose. I forgot that Brendan Gleeson was here.
Completely forgot he was in here until he's here. And he's in it more than I thought.
Yeah. McCoy is looking through a digital camera, and he put what was in the camera in his left jacket pocket. This is just absurd setup. Naya finds Ambrose and tries grabbing what was in his pocket. He stops her as she puts what was in his pocket in hers and asks her to put down $1,000 for him. Naya leaves and Hugh smashes his hand in the swinging doors. Hugh's just not having a good day. Ethan appears behind Naya and asks how she did, and she then goes, "What are you going to do, spank me?" as she gives Ethan the camera. Luther watches the tape, and it is of someone who is exposed to chimera and getting decimated from the inside out. You know, seeing one person get gunks of makeup put on them like this is not very scary to me. If I saw a whole community of people being taken out, that might scare me, but we're just seeing what it does to one person.
Well, what's also inconsistent is that they send her out in the third act to be a contagion, like patient zero, but apparently they got the cure in a quick amount of time, because I don't think it would have taken 20 hours. Australia should have turned into 28 days later by the end of this movie. If the virus acts as quickly as it's supposed to. Which also, I think one of the things that dates this movie also, like I said, is just the virus super weapon subplot. And it's just a generic thing of, oh, we're going to sell it to terrorists.
Uh-huh, we're selling it to Middle Eastern people.
I'm bored. This is when you're explaining everything that's going on. We're an hour into the film. And I mean, thank God this thing isn't 2.5 hours, though it could be 30 minutes shorter if you cut the slow-mo.
Dude, this thing is 2.5 hours. This is about 220.
Is it that long? I thought it was like 205, 210. But I'm bored. Mm. I don't care about Sean and his fucking posse at his house. I think outside of his fucking blonde henchman, there's just nobody with personality. This thing is, goddamn, I'm as slow-mo as fucking Woo cinematographer.
We see Hugh coming up behind them, and Ethan asks Naya to leave the job and go to Australia. He tells Naya that if she doesn't get out of Ambrose's house, he's going in and getting her out himself.
Which they could do right now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, the team is there, she's there. They have the info. They know also, where Sean lives.
Yeah, why don't they ever just capture him?
They have him. Absolutely, they're just monitoring it. Are they trying to capture him in the act?
I was going to say, you have him outnumbered, you're in a public place. Yeah.
The script is Mission Impossible.
We then cut to Naya putting the card in Sean's right jacket pocket, guys. Right jacket pocket.
Oh, no.
He then gets the card disgustingly and says that he's not going to miss this opportunity. We cut to McCoy getting gassed up in a car. We then see Naya trying to find Sean in his house as she runs and is grabbed by Ethan. He asks if she's okay as we cut to McCoy in the hospital. He wakes up to see who he thinks is Nickervich coming to visit him. He says that dead is a little extreme and tells McCoy that he's infected with chimera and he won't give up the Bellerophon, which is the cure for this thing. He confesses he's in business to make money and that he needs to go back to work as Nekrovich rips off his face to reveal Ethan, and we see it is Sean who is disguised as Ethan. Again, this is when the masks get out of control.
Twice, yeah. In 30 seconds.
Yeah, the masks are out of control here. Matt, you called this out earlier.
Yeah, and I hate how the editing is intentionally misdirecting, because you think that Sean is the one who kidnaps the Brendan Gleeson character, but it's all a ruse. They go through way too much trouble to get information when there are such a thing as just straightforward, especially because this is one of those movies you're on a ticking clock and nobody fucking acts like it.
Yeah, the ticking clock. We even have a ticking clock in this. We don't even cut to the watch at all. We don't even know what the what time it is.
No, Jack Bauer would be going, come on, guys.
On its surface, this scene is kind of cool. Kidnap, the play back and forth. But because they overdo it, because it's done too much, it takes away from what, on its surface, is a pretty smart scene. And then they got to find a way to screw it up.
It's also dumb. I think this movie talked about how it spoon feeds you information. We already saw this doctor die. Sean broke his neck.
Uh-huh.
So there's no surprise here for this sequence. And also, Naya can't tell that's a goddamn mask. Like, I'm sure if you kiss that, you would feel the fabric. It's not synthetic skin where it's 100% matching.
Yeah. Donald Gleason's character, did he not know that the doctor was on the plane that crashed?
No, he did, because he's like, you're dead.
Yeah.
Ethan concludes that Ambrose has the virus and needs the cure. As Sean and Hugh, they conclude that they know where Ethan will be tonight. We cut to McCoy waking up in a car, and he's told that his normal driver has gone home sick with the flu. And then we cut to Ethan and Luther. They're going over their plan on how they're going to obtain the Bellerophon.
Is it just repeating what the first movie did? Yeah,
exactly.
Now, I'm going to give this a compliment, since they're far and few between.
Good luck.
I like, while they're explaining what's going on, though it would have been great if we would have seen some of them working together, I like that we see Ethan and Ambrose both describing what they are going to be doing in the frame of what their jobs would have been playing doubles. If this would have been, God damn, this is a face-off movie. This discussion that they're having, I think, is some pretty cool shit.
Okay, I was not expecting the dialogue of this movie to get complimented, but okay.
Just the way that it's being done, you
know. I know. I'm
he's going shit. To do this. I'm going to do this. Then I'm going to do this. And then he's going to do that.
Boys, is it just me, or is this next scene trying its best to be the safe infiltration scene from last week?
Oh, yeah. Just wait, because this film ends up being about as important for infiltration sequences as anything.
Luther says they have a total of 40 seconds to get Ethan in and the cables loose. We cut to Ethan in a helicopter being driven by Billy. Luther says he's not ready yet as Ethan is dropped, and we have an elongated scene of Ethan jumping and slipping into the building. He goes all the way down and straightens himself out as he lets loose of the cables and clears them right on time. You know, this is not nearly as captivating as last week's safe infiltration scene. I think that's fairly obvious, but I will say I am actually engaged at this point. I do like what they're doing here.
Yep.
It goes away really quick because we're going to see Tom Cruise double fist fucking guns and shoot at the bad guys, which, God, it drives me nuts. It's okay when Wu has his buddies do that, but when you have Tom Cruise jump kicking and double fisting guns and jumping and shooting, it doesn't translate very well.
I'm sure Tom Cruise has done plenty of double fisting in his time. It's not the way that you think.
Good Lord. Did not mean it like that. Ethan starts his Casio watch as we cut to Sean going over his own plan. As Adam mentioned earlier, Luther tells Ethan that they're going to be out of contact in 8 minutes, given the generators are going out. So Ethan drops in and starts getting rid of the virus in exact ways that Sean outlines. Hugh and Sean, they show up, and the race is on. Luther says that Naya is in the building, which I actually thought was kind of funny. I giggled at that. Ethan is terminating Chimera one step at a time as Sean and Hugh get closer. Luther says all they can do is hope, and he kills all the bugs before the blue dot gets to the red one. Ethan is found, though, and he's shot at as glass goes everywhere. More slow-mo as Ethan shoots back, John Woo style. These action scenes, they just do nothing for me.
Fine for a few seconds. And then I like this style of action that John Woo has brought to so many movies. It doesn't work in this. Maybe it's because of the actors that are doing it that it's just, I don't know, it feels so over-rehearsed. The slow-mo doesn't help. I don't like it. They start an action scene, and for the first 10 to 30 seconds, I'm like, okay, we look pretty sweet. And then it's gone. So it can't hold me through a single action scene.
The problem is, it feels like someone trying to be John Woo. It feels like it was put through a dryer. It's not the purest. It's the Diet Coke of John Woo. And I also don't buy Tom Cruise doing these bicycle jump kicks.
Exactly.
All that kind of stuff. It's...
I hate that.
If he did this in the first movie, I'd be okay. At least it's consistent. But this adds to my disbelief that this is the same character.
You guys are right.
He might as well be fucking Leon Kennedy from Resident Evil.
You guys are right. Fundamentally, this is just a completely different character than we saw last week. His motivations, everything is just completely gone. We see a bomb being placed in Luther's van, and he turns on his spidey sense, I guess, and sneaks out before it explodes.
Yeah. 20 seconds is not enough time. Yeah. I'm sorry.
We see Sean and Ethan. They're shooting at each other before Sean starts antagonizing him. I do like that Sean calls out how much Tom Cruise grins. I thought that was kind of funny. Compliments when I can give them out, folks. Ethan points out that the last of the anecdote is sitting right there as Sean brings out Naya. Sean says she wouldn't be there if it wasn't for Hunt, and that Ethan is now responsible for what happens to her. Ethan doesn't have to make the choice as Naya makes it for him and injects herself with the chimera, and my God, is this scene painful.
The melody, the music, yes. Everything about it, the random sparks flying everywhere, the lighting, this is just...
Makes her look stupid. They literally make her the MacGuffin. And also this makes the doctor look stupid because he injects himself with one to kind of make himself the only person susceptible, but he didn't burn the other samples. Apparently there were more of them.
What would happen to the doctor if there was a flight delay? Would he just I mean, we've all flown United. Shit.
Yeah. I just hate this when Ethan's like, "What are you doing?" And she responds with, "I wasn't thinking." Oh my God, this is just stupid. Oh, the worst scene of this series is this scene here. And then we're having slow-mo shootouts to Zimmer's themes, and she's asking Ethan to shoot her. He responds that they have 19 hours and 38 minutes and that he's not going to lose her. And then Ethan runs out without her. Sean asks Naya to die so that she can make him a lot of money. Meanwhile, Ethan says that they don't have a lot of time, and he goes over the plans with Luther and Billy. We then cut to our boy Cruz doing more climbing as Sean pulls up with his team, but not Naya. There's a ton of security, but this doesn't stop our superhero Ethan from jump kicking and then doing some slow motion leg drops to the gut. And by the way, what is this lair? Have we seen this lair before? Where's this located?
Yes, we saw it in Die Another Day. It's where they had the... It's the medical clinic where homeboy got the diamonds taken out of his face in Cuba, isn't it? I swear that's the same spot.
It seems like it.
Well, not to mention, okay, it's an island except for a bridge, right? But he shows up on a boat.
Yep.
Are you only fucking looking one direction?
Yeah, it's a good thing he picked one side of the island to infiltrate, because if he picked the other side, he would have been fucked.
We cut to McCoy and Sean. They're starting their deal as Ethan continues making his way through their guards, including a leg scissors as doves fly. Oh, the fucking doves in this movie.
Thank God.
God damn it. Call Prince, because these doves make me cry.
Yeah, at least the movie finally woke me up at this point.
You know they're coming because it's John Woo.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, if you watch the trailer for this thing, you might as well have called this Dove the Movie. Hey, you know that guy. Guess what he does in film? But they don't do it once. They do it like four times, and it's all here.
Adam,
and one of them fucking gives him away.
Luther tells Ethan that Naya has been dropped off somewhere in Sydney, and things aren't going well with this negotiation as Ethan runs through doves and once again does a Jet Li-style jump kick. Ethan then throws something that explodes when shot at as Sean and Hugh, they fall for the banana in the tailpipe. Ethan emerges from the fire through doves.
I'm glad the birds are fireproof.
Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness they don't get sick.
Thank God none of them get in the crossfire. I thought this was going to be like in Batman 66 where we find out a porpoise blocked a torpedo.
Or it was going to be a Randy Johnson situation where he threw the ball at the bird. You know, one thing I did love about doing the plot summary for this movie was I didn't have to pause it at all. There's so much goddamn slow motion, I could catch up pretty quick. It's going on.
If you don't know what's going on, the movie takes the time for three different people to tell you.
Exactly. McCoy orders the transfer stop as a hunt is on for Ethan Hunt. But again, these goddamn doves emerge as Ethan attacks. You tells Ethan to raise... Go ahead.
Pause. Okay, even in 2000, if you start a transfer of something on a computer, you don't have to watch your screen for that to continue.
They have amazing Wi-Fi capabilities in this abandoned... This is 2000. Operating systems and internet connectivity was nowhere near as advanced as it is now. This transaction would have taken 3 hours. Remember, it took you 5 goddamn hours to watch a 5-second clip from The Phantom Menace.
Hugh tells Ethan to raise his hands as Ethan reveals a grenade. The fight goes on as an explosion happens. Smoke emerges from the doorway, but we don't know what exactly happened. Sean is told that the transfer is completed as we cut to Hugh walking in with Hunt, or so we think. Sean shoots who he thinks is Ethan in the leg, and Sean tells him to stop mumbling. He asks for a big smile as he tells McCoy to get down on his knees. He then says that this is what is known as getting your gun off, as he unloads right into who he thinks is Ethan Hunt. But a closer look reveals it was actually Hugh, as his chopped off finger is revealed and his mask is taken off.
This is stupid. This is horrible. You know what? I'm going to give it a compliment. I like him killing his own henchmen and the reveal of it being done. It makes no sense. How many different did Cruz bring one for every henchman just for the possibility? And he already had the vocal adapter down. No sense whatsoever. But I like Cruz running away and ripping that mask off.
It's also dumb that he can't recognize the height discrepancy between the two of them. And the mask, you can clearly tell it's a mask because he put the camera on lockdown and he runs towards it. And you can see it kind of flapping as he's running.
Yeah, Kevin Yeager did the mask for this one as opposed to Rob Bottin last week. And, you know, for practical effects in 2000, they're not bad, but sometimes the seams do show.
This one just overuses.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's the overuse that damns it.
Yep.
Hugh, a.k.a. Ethan, runs from the scene. And I'll say this, I have shit on this movie almost this entire podcast, but if I were to tell you I didn't enjoy this last half hour, I would be lying. I did kind of enjoy a few of these scenes. Ethan has a hard time reaching Luther because he's small, as Ethan shoots some gas cans to make them explode and take out a bad guy.
This is when I'm done. As soon as he escapes from this place, I wish that I had some freaking chimera to shove in my arm. From this moment, as soon as we decide that we're going to bring a motocross team to this fucking island, I am out. I am out hard.
Yeah, except I would have been saying to the doctor, inject it into my veins because I love the last 20 minutes of this movie.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for backing me up on that.
Because I wish the whole movie was this hyper-stylized.
I do too.
Because at least would have been enjoyable. Like if they made Torque with Jamie Presley for 2 hours, I would have been okay. Because look, this is stupid. This is bombastic. But this to me at least would have fit a plot this stupid.
This is Face Off.
I'm enjoying myself at the end of this. I wasn't enjoying myself at the end of Face Off.
This and Triple X are almost indistinguishable.
Yeah. Ethan then shoots a thug on a motorcycle as he takes it. And here we have our first of many instances of Ethan on a motorcycle that we're going to be seeing in this series. The chase is on and Luther even gets in on the shooting action. Ethan makes his way on a bridge right through some flames. Chopper flies in close as Ethan is rolling around on his motorcycle. He grabs a gun in slow motion and does a front wheelie before turning around a slow motion again and taking out a car. This was fucking glorious. I'm sorry. I like this.
But this is so 90s, it might as well be sponsored by Mountain Dew.
The chase continues as Luther once again updates Ethan on Naya's location. Ethan tells Luther to bring her to him as his earpiece is failing, and we just see Naya walking around aimlessly. What is the point of this? She's the damsel in distress at this point.
She's the damsel in distress. She's the MacGuffin. She might as well be MacGuffin the way that she is in this film. And also, downtown Sydney is about 6 hours that way on foot. She's up on a fucking cliff.
Oh, God, this is... Whenever they cut to her, I'm reminded, oh, that's right, this movie blows.
Yeah, that's it. Matt and I are lockstep with the end of this film. I'm exactly like you, sir. Ethan creates a smoke screen with his motorcycle tires as he causes another crash. We see another car flip, and then we see that Sean is now in full pursuit on a red motorcycle. Some gunfire is exchanged, and Ethan has done this. Let's pull this gun out of my back pocket move a few times now.
Yeah, and apparently this is a world where these pistols have unlimited clip.
Naya is still walking around on this cliff, this time to the edge. As we cut back to the chase, we get some more near misses before we see what I remember most about this movie. These two bumping in mid-air as their bikes explode, Milli Vanilli style.
Oh, I love when they fucking launching each other. This is the kind of ridiculous absurdity I wanted, and I hate that they made me wait what felt like 3 days for it.
Yeah,
Speed Racer says physics don't work that way.
Oh, this is the precursor to what Fast and Furious will do.
It's ridiculous. Sure. It's ridiculous. Again, I would lie if I didn't say I didn't enjoy it. We cut to the ocean hitting the rock because this is a John Woo movie. We got to create this drama as Ethan and Ambrose, they start fighting each other. Ethan tears off his jacket and they're going at it as water hits and Naya is closing her eyes.
And she doesn't have a watch, so thank God she could tell time by the sun.
If you're dead set on suicide, why not jump off the first building you see?
Right. So since we have our own channel, I'll go ahead and say, Matt, how great was this Goldberg spear that Cruz does here?
Oh, this feels as choreographed. Like, this is so choreographed, I half expected a referee to come out.
Ethan is then stabbed in the face and damn near in the eye. This is another scene I remember. Ethan throws a knife down, more jump kicks and punches, and waves are abound. Luther spots Naya as Ethan does a rock bottom and set of jump kicks. Massive one sends Sean sprawling as the ocean calms down. Ethan has his hand raised to finish Sean off, but the helicopter approaches and Luther runs to them. But Sean is not dead. He raises a gun and says that Ethan should have killed him.
So I felt halfway through this film. He should have killed me.
Ethan then kicks his gun up, avoids Sean's shot, and lays down before firing a few rounds that are right on target. So this
hard
is
hard target, if you will.
Yeah, and this is how Doug Ray Scott's big action American career ended.
This extended work they put in this last 30 minutes is why we have Hugh Jackman as Wolverine.
Mm-hmm. So. Exactly.
Luther, you know, somewhere, I wonder if Hugh Jackman's ever seen this movie and just gone, oh, thank God.
Isn't Scott, he's Australian as well, isn't he?
Yeah, well, it seemed like they were dead set on getting an Australian between him and Crowe for Wolverine. You know, it's funny, Russell Crowe could have played this part.
Because
that's the other thing. If you're going to have a big movie star as your hero, I kind of want a comparable one as the villain. Because John Travolta and Nick Cage, they were both like at the top of their game, so to speak. And look, I kind of want to see Tom Cruise fight Russell Crowe. I would pay to watch that, especially if the referee came in and threw a telephone in the middle of that and said, fight.
Well, I'm trying to imagine Doug Ray Scott uttering bub, and I just can't. Who the hell made this casting? Unless they just thought X-Men was just not going to do well, and they were just like getting who they could.
The thing that would have been worse, how Wolverine-centric the movies are. At least if you're casting Wolverine as like a supporting character, you'd be like, okay, he's not great, but it's not like he takes away. But the fact that the first three movies are basically Wolverine featuring the X-Men.
Of all the screen tests and all the stuff that have been leaked out over the last several years, that I've seen no footage of Doug Ray Scott as Logan is a miss. I really want
to
see it.
Getting back to this movie, Luther injects Naya with the antidote as Ethan approaches her yet again, and they once again just look at each other with longing eyes. We hear that Naya now has no sign of the virus. Ethan then tells Swanbeck that the virus was destroyed by fire, and Swanbeck says that Naya's criminal record is now expunged, as in wiped out. But Ethan did not accomplish his mission of getting Chimera to him.
Yeah, which is a weird...
He's basically like, eh, don't worry about it.
Yeah!
It almost could be set up that he was being villainous in his design, and to Matt's point earlier, that would have been a much better way to go.
Ethan then says he doesn't know exactly where Naya is, but his plans are now to go on vacation, but he doesn't have to say where, as it wouldn't be a vacation if he did. We cut to...
Aha!
Yeah. We cut to Ethan and Naya once again looking at each other, embracing and kissing.
What the fuck is happening at this picnic? Because there's guys juggling fire, there's... What is this?
I swore they were standing in front of a fucking green screen until they walked actually through it. What the shit?
And credits roll on Mission Impossible 2 to the song that put Napster in the clutches of Metallica. Ugh. And as a diehard Metallica fan, God, I hate this song. At the time, I was a diehard Metallica fan, not much anymore. All right, boys, scale of 1 to 10. Boy, what an anime discussion this has been. What do we give Mission Impossible 2? Adam, go ahead, sir.
Animated discussion. You know what? Maybe they should make an animated Mission Impossible film or series, because this defies the laws of practicality like any animated movie that has ever been done. Other than Tom Cruise... being here, there is almost no correlation between this movie and the movie that came before it. Ving Rhames even feels like a different character. Those are the only two you have coming back. This movie seemed to be preoccupied with getting John Woo and finding a reason to have Tom Cruise smile as big as he could. The screenplay, the script is a absolute mess. It's a disaster. It is the virus in this film, is this script. It makes no sense. Stop making movies where you create an action scene and then you want to find a way to attach them together. Because that's Mission Impossible for enjoyment for your audience. It's a shame that this character seems to have changed so much. He becomes a James Bond wannabe. Not even a good Bond. What they do with Tandy Newton's character, Miss Naya Hall, is inexcusable. It's insulting. It was insulting to me then. It's more insulting now. It's despicable. This shit is so far all over the place. It makes no sense. There are some flashes of pretty good action. There's some cinematography that at points are like, ooh, that's cool to look at. That's neat. But it goes away so damn quickly. Nothing can hold my interest. This is John Woo on Ritalin and Monster and Red Bull and Tom Cruise jacked up to 11 with nothing holding them in check. And it's stunning that this film made as much as it did, that it was the highest grossing film. This thing is a bona fide hit, but at the same time, it was relentlessly panned the second it was done. And I think for pretty damn good reason. It decided to not follow anything that came before for Mission Impossible. It decided to just be another mid-level 90s action movie in a 2000. This thing is bad. And that it's such a giant step down from the enjoyment last week. As flawed as that movie was, it was enjoyable. I don't find much to enjoy here. I watched it again for this, and I can now remember why I haven't watched it in 20 years. This thing's... I was going to be generous. I don't feel like it, because I'm mad. I'm giving this a 3 on 10.
Wow. 3 from Adam on Mission Impossible 2. Matt, second time we've reviewed this together, my friend. What do you give Mission Impossible 2?
Well, the theme song that they got Limp Bizkit to come in and reorganize, instead of saying dun, 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 this should have been dumb, dumb, dumb. Because God, is this movie stupid. And quite frankly, it's the outlier of this whole franchise because of Tom Cruise just being out of control. And honestly, I feel like John Woo kind of sleepwalk until the last 25 minutes until they woke him up out of his chair and said, hey, here's a pot of coffee and $30 worth of Taco Bell. Go have some fun. Because I love the last part of this movie, but I don't feel like it's worth the slog to get here. And I think it gives into a lot of Cruise's worst tendencies with his big installments. Everyone else takes a backseat to him, from the villain to the quote-unquote love interest who has done tremendous disservice. Luther is just here to be the guy behind the chair. And quite frankly, I find a lot of this movie to be shockingly dull up until the last portion. So it doesn't outweigh the bad, but if there was a way that I could go from vehement dislike to just walking out on like a contact high, that's kind of how I feel about this movie. I'll be more generous than Adam, but I still feel in large the same way that I did all those years ago. This is just, it's not good. It's a 4 on 10.
A 4 from Goudreau. You know, it's no secret that the three of us are best friends. Both these guys are going to be at my wedding. But God forbid if somewhere down the line, two of us decide we've had enough of the other and we decide to start our own thing. God forbid they release another Mission Impossible around that time. Guess what? I'm not going to watch this and review it again. This was painful. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that John Woo's style just does not translate with a film about espionage. And in American cinema, he has brought his Hong Kong style and it just doesn't work. This movie is so painful to get through because we have everything that I hate. People falling in love because they are just here. We have a man and a woman and they have to fall in love. We have unexplained plots such as Ambrose and Hunt. How did they become partners? How did they disintegrate as partners at IMF? We have an indescribable former love story of Ambrose and our damsel in distress here. And I completely agree with both of you in that Tandy Newton is so misused here. It is no secret why she did not want to come back next week. She is not good, and it's no fault of hers. This is poorly written. I'm not going to say it's poorly directed, because much like Matt, I have fun with the last 20 or so minutes of this movie. I think once we get our heads going at it, it's fun stuff, but it's not worth going through the first 2 hours or so to get to that point. So I have the same score written down as Matt does. I have a 4 just because of that last 20 minutes pretty much. But God, just stay away from this. It's the outlier of the series. It really doesn't play into any of the future installments. We're going to get that next week. So you have every reason to stay away from this unless you just love 90s, early 2000s action. Just stay the fuck away. 4 out of 10 for Mission Impossible 2. Percolated Media listeners, I believe next week we're going to have fights. And for once, it is not going to involve me. I have heard the opening scene of this movie no less than 50 times, given by somebody I'm not going to out, but his name rhymes with Batum. I have heard this impression over and over. We're finally going to get to review Mission Impossible 3, and these two are on opposite ends of that spectrum, and I'm going to hold off on how I feel until next week. But Adam, what are you expecting when we get to Mission Impossible 3 next week?
I think it's going to be interesting. I think this one's going to be polarizing. I just have a feeling based on who's involved, based on writing, directing, and even general consensus. I think we're going to see some fireworks. I just got a feeling.
Adam has a feeling. Goudreau, how's your feeling about next week?
Trepidation. because, as Adam mentioned, some of the players involved, I have a long, much like Tom Cruise, I have a long and complicated history with some of the players. And honestly, there's not a lot in this movie that I remember, having not watched it since 2018. So I think, much like the first two, this is going to feel like a first time watch in a lot of ways. But maybe something will trigger in my mind. I certainly hope I'm more positive than I was to this one.
I think that's almost a guarantee. I haven't watched it since, Matt, you and I did this series those years ago. I'm curious to go back to it, because I remember coming out of the theater really, really enjoying it, much like this one we just reviewed. But who knows? After I watch it again, maybe my thoughts will change. We'll get to that next week. Boys, it's been a joy going through Mission Impossible 2 with you guys. I'm sad that there hasn't been any slow motion or anything. If we were going to do any of that, that would have been this week. But next week, we're going to get some high-octane J.J. Abrams action. So until next week, when we get to Mission Impossible 3, this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Thank you, boys.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Go!
It's Benji. Where am I going?
They're coming.
We're not ready.
Then get ready.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You can understand you're very upset. Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Your line's not long enough! No shit!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So let me get this straight. When there's a mission none of you can handle, you just leave word for a nameless man and hope he gets the job done. Is that it?
Should he choose to accept?
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I am waiting.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, The Planet of the Apes franchise,
The Lethal Weapon series, The Movies of the Alien franchise,
The Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park,
the ongoing Marvel series,
and so many more.
Well, this is not Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's Mission Impossible.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
He made it! He made it!
I knew he'd make it.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Scheduling by Matt.
Read this. Slowly.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Listen. Talk to me. We can talk. Like gentlemen.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Benji, did you recover anything?
Yes, yes. Despite the aforementioned conditions of the hard drive you brought back,
I managed to recover portions of 24 email files, also made what I believe to be a thoroughly promotion-worthy breakthrough.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You wanted me to listen. This is me listening.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
That was not easy, but I did it.
Adam Test.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Garrett, stay off the internet. Superman trailer.
Oh, shit. You know, sometimes I am really, really upset that I have to do these plot summaries, and then sometimes I get Mission Impossible 2.
Did ChatGPT exist in 2000?
And 2006?
God damn it, Matt, this is fucking melodramatic.
It is, but that's also very in tune with how Face Off opens.
God, you guys just love Face Off. You know what I love about
it? I do. I love that movie also because if you've ever watched John Travolta talk about it on Inside the Actors Studio, it's one of the funniest interviews because he read the script. He's like, this is going to be the worst movie ever made. But it's also worth noting, if you guys don't know, that movie was originally going to be Michael Douglas and Harrison Ford.
I am aware of that. You know what I love about the three of us, though? The three of us, we all have a different favorite John Woo movie. You love Face Off. Adam loves Broken Arrow. I love Hard Target, but I'm a Van Damme.
I like Hard Target, too, but I'm also not, and I'm not a Van Damme apologist or anything, mm-hmm. but I think he's got some decent movies. But you're right, this opening also... But this is so 90s, it might as well be sponsored by Mountain Dew.
Absolutely. Might as well be sponsored by Mountain Dew. Why not say Surge?
Or what was the other? Oh, Volt was Volt, the one?
Yeah, Jolt.
Jolt no, Cola, no, there was Volt as well.
Vault, yep. Like V-A-U-L-T.
I don't remember. Vault? I don't remember that one.
Yeah, that was Coke's equivalent.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Because like everyone made their own, like, look, this is more interesting than the movie. Everyone tried to make their own like Mountain Dew copycat. There was Mellow Yellow, which I think predates Mountain Dew.
Mm-hmm.
Could be wrong, but Volt.
Days of Thunder.
Yeah, Volt, same color. Tasted pretty similar, but I mean, look, Mountain Dew will always be the king.
Have you guys tried the C4 that has like these different color, different like flavors?
No, because I don't want my heart to explode.
Never had a C4. You're the one with the heart condition. Put the energy drink.
It says zero sugar, though. It's zero sugar.
Yeah, but it's the caffeine.
Chimera has zero sugar. That doesn't mean you should have it.
Let's chase. And this is how This is how, what's this actor's name? Oh, what's his name?
Doug Ray Scott.
Doug
Ray
Scott. The character, okay. Ambrose?
Yeah, Doug Ray Scott. This is how Doug Ray Scott's big action